You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The highlight of the NAACP Centennial Conference in New York this week is President Obama's speech, which is scheduled for tonight. Jonathan Capehart, an editorial writer for The Washington Post and a regular contributor to MSNBC, joins us now to discuss what the president's speech is likely to cover and its special significance on the 100th anniversary of the organization. We'll also discuss some of the issues in the news recently, from the confirmation hearings for Judge Sonia Sotomayor to gay rights, to the turmoil in the Republican Party. And I'm very pleased to welcome Jonathan back to our show. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Leonard. Thanks for this. What a treat this is. I can't remember if you've ever actually interviewed me or we've been on together. So this is great. I'm very happy about this.
We have on the phone. The only times you've been here have been when you've been the guest host on our show. So it must feel odd to be on the other side.
I know, just a little bit.
Well, this is the first time that Barack Obama is addressing the NAACP as the president of the United States.
Right.
What was the gist of his speech at the convention last year when he was just a candidate?
Well, last year, when he was a candidate, he spoke at, obviously, the 99th anniversary. And then he was a candidate, and his speech, and I pulled it back up, and I read it this morning, and it was your basic campaign speech. I mean, the president, then the candidate, made a point of delivering the same message no matter where he went, whether he was talking to Latino groups or African-American groups or middle-class voters or white voters all over the country. It was all about economic opportunity, making sure that Wall Street was being true and faithful to folks on Main Street who depend on, you know, the stock market for their 401ks and things like that. And the interesting thing, you know, in rereading the speech, which was done in July of last year, to have in mind what we've been through since September 15th, when we all awoke to the news that our economic world as we knew it was completely upended. And when you read his words and his words about, you know, getting Wall Street under control and compensation and all of those things, it's actually incredibly prescient. So now that here we are a year later, he's now the president of the United States. He's now dealing with an economy that was in free fall and seems to be in less of a free fall, but still not out of the woods yet, trying to push through a health care package, trying to push through a climate change package. This is a chief executive whose plate is full, and I would suspect when he speaks there tonight, you're going to hear him again, like, as he's been doing over the last few days since coming back from overseas, pushing really hard to send the message that if we're going to recover economically, we must have health care reform be a major piece of that. Otherwise, we will crumble under the weight of increased health care costs. But of course, there's huge historical significance to the speech he's going to give tonight.
Well, he has resisted casting himself as a black president. In fact, he hasn't addressed the issue of race much since his speech in Philadelphia when he was campaigning for president.
Right.
Are you surprised at all by that? Obviously, you just pointed out he hardly mentioned race last year at the convention, even though it was the NAACP and he was hoping to get as many black votes as he could.
Right. I mean, and I don't want to give the impression that he didn't address race, or at least give a nod to the significance of his, you know, standing there before them. I mean, he talked about Dr. King and Congressman Lewis and Julian Bond, who is the chairman of the NAACP, and how they were in their mid-20s when the March on Washington was led, and when they were leading, when Dr. King led the bus boycotts, and when Congressman Lewis was 26 years old at the time of the March on Washington. And so he acknowledged and reveled in the fact that he was standing on enormous shoulders to be there as the Democratic nominee for president of the United States. Tonight, now he's president. And yes, he hasn't addressed race head on since that speech in Philadelphia. And he has been very reticent about being the black president, as opposed to being the president of the United States who happens to be black. I think he's, since the campaign and since inauguration, he has been striving very hard to be seen as a president for all of the people, who is working really hard on the whole host of issues that are cramming his inbox.
Well, one of the things, one of the racial issues he did address last year led to a certain amount of trouble for him. He spoke about the importance of personal responsibility in the black community, and Jesse Jackson said that he felt he was talking down to black people. I'd like to play a little clip from that.
I know that Thurgood Marshall did not argue Brown versus Board of Education so that some of us could just stop doing our jobs as parents. That wasn't the deal. I know that nine little children didn't walk through a schoolhouse door in Little Rock so we could stand by and let our children drop out of school and turn to gangs for the support they're not getting elsewhere in the community. That's not the freedom that we fought to achieve. That's not the America that our leadership sought to build. That's not the dream they had for our children.
And that was Barack Obama, not Bill Cosby, running for president.
Well, you notice, I'm glad you played that clip, because notice what happened as he delivered those remarks. The cheering and applause rose as he kept going, talking about personal responsibility and responsibility of parents and the responsibility of communities. NAACP is a middle-class organization, and there are plenty of people within the NAACP, and actually a whole lot more, who aren't members of the NAACP, who are very concerned about the breakdown of morals and mores, and who want to reinstill a sense of discipline and self-confidence in their families, in their communities, and in their children. And so then candidate Obama, and now President Obama, he's been their champion in terms of saying, look, the way things have been going have not been good enough and aren't good enough. And if things are going to get better for us, meaning African Americans, and us as Americans, then we've got to clean up our act. And you know, Reverend Jackson didn't like that. And remember, he was caught on mic at a Fox interview saying that he wanted to
say something the FCC won't allow us to say.
Right. He wanted to emasculate him. And that had more to do with not feeding into the complaints of some in the black community that the president was always lecturing African Americans about what they should be doing, and had more to do with the fact that you had this. There is, I believe, some generational jealousy and some personal jealousies between Reverend Jackson, you know, leader of the civil rights movement from the 60s, and President Obama, who was the Democratic nominee for president and who everyone, even at that point, said stood a very good shot of winning.
Well, that generational gap has been on the minds of a lot of people at the NAACP. Their new president is the youngest they've ever had. And there are people who are suggesting that the election of Barack Obama may have made the NAACP somewhat irrelevant.
Well, I mean, I'm...
They obviously have to change their focus.
Right. I mean, they need to find a way to make themselves relevant to Ben Jealous's generation, Ben Jealous being the new head of the NAACP, who is himself in his 20s. But, I mean, he's an old soul. He's a very impressive person, but he's a 20-something-year-old person who's leading an organization that, for better or for worse, is stuck in its glory days of the 60s, of the civil rights movement. It's a board that is extremely large. I think there are between 50 and 60 board members. I remember interviewing Julian Bond for a piece on In the Life for PBS, and I asked him, how do you manage with a board that large? And also, the problem with the board is that I'm not sure actually of the average age of the board, but I can guarantee you this, it's nowhere near in the 20s or the 30s or maybe even the 40s. I mean, it's a board filled with people who, you know, very distinguished, great backgrounds, but when you're when you're dealing with a 100-year-old organization in the 21st century with a 20-something-year-old
he's actually 36.
He's 36.
Yeah.
Still,
but that's he's very young.
Very young. You need to have the organization needs to change and position itself to make itself relevant to the folks who are coming up and who will be, you know, following in Barack Obama's footsteps.
I'm talking with Jonathan Capehart, who's an editorial writer for The Washington Post, a regular contributor to MSNBC, and also a regular fill-in on this show. We are always grateful to you, Jonathan, because you do such a great job. You mentioned your conversation with Julian Bond last year, because there is a whole other issue that it seems to me that the NAACP seems to be skirting around, and that's the matter of whether gay rights is also a civil right. Judging from what happened in California, this is a major should be of concern to people in the black community.
Mm-hmm.
What did Julian Bond say when you asked him about that?
Well, when I asked him specifically about gay marriage, you know, he's for it. The organization itself, however, has not taken a position, and it's a very contentious issue within the NAACP. And here you have a situation where the chairman is for it, and then last week on MSNBC, Ben Jealous was asked what he thought about same-sex marriage, and he personally he didn't want to go there. He didn't think that it was something that the organization needed to focus on because there are so many other issues facing the African-American community that he felt were more pressing, economics and housing and education, which, you know, I don't fault him on that at all.
But there are a fair number of gay people within the African-American community, just as there are in every other community.
Oh, absolutely. And that's not to say that there aren't leaders in the African-American community who aren't pushing very hard on gay rights, or, and this is more contentious, I think, than whether the NAACP or African Americans support same-sex marriage. It's the equating the civil rights movement, the '60s civil rights movement, with the civil rights movement for gays and lesbians. Huge schism. There are lots of African Americans who don't see the connection, who don't appreciate that gay leaders try to hook themselves to the civil rights movement. But then you have very strong voices within the African American community who say, no, 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 there is a connection. One of the most eloquent speeches I've heard making that connection was given by Congressman John Lewis about how gay civil rights and the regular civil rights, the 60s civil rights movement, are part of the same struggle for equal rights. He gave this speech at the Human Rights Campaign dinner here in Washington in 2003 or 2004.
And Mildred Loving, the wife in the Supreme Court case, Loving versus Virginia, which ended
right.
the ban on interracial marriage, came out in favor of marriage equality for gay people.
Yes, as did Coretta Scott King. Before she died, Reverend Al Sharpton is someone who makes the link in the two civil rights movements, and who also is in favor of same-sex marriage. Julian Bond, the same thing. So there's and the other thing about that's heartening is that here what we see is a generational divide throughout the country when it comes to same-sex marriage, where you have older Americans less favorably disposed to it than younger Americans. And here you have, at least in the case of Julian Bond and Congressman Lewis, you have two lions of the civil rights movement who say unequivocally that that the two struggles are part of the same common human struggle for equality, which I think is terrific for both communities.
Although Barack Obama doesn't seem to feel that way, and we'll come back to that and other issues. We'll talk about health care. We'll talk about what's going on in the Republican Party and whatever else we can get to. maybe a little on Sonia Sotomayor, as I continue my conversation with Jonathan Capehart, an editorial writer for The Washington Post and a regular contributor to MSNBC. We're back with Jonathan Capehart. We're talking about the president's speech tonight before the NAACP and other matters, other political matters. And, Jonathan, I don't want to spend too much more time on gay rights, but haven't many people in the gay community expressed disappointment in President Obama's record so far?
Yes. There's a huge disconnect the community feels between candidate Obama, who was extremely supportive up to the point of supporting same-sex marriage, which he did not and does not. And then once he became president, he said nothing about gay rights or where it fits in with his agenda for the country. And there were a lot of rumblings when Richard Socarides wrote a piece for the Washington Post op-ed page saying, you know, it's been 100 days, where's our fierce advocate? That sort of exposed the rumblings within the gay community of, like, where is the president on our issues? And then, unfortunately, because the president hadn't said anything related to gay rights, when the Justice Department filed its brief in a case challenging the Defense of Marriage Act and set off a firestorm of anger within the community, that was the first substantive thing to come out of the Obama administration on gay rights since inauguration. And the problem with that is that the president had been working on a whole host of things related to the gay community below the radar that, they came to light, obviously, afterwards, June being Gay Pride Month. I think the plan was to reveal these things throughout the month, but they took on the flavor of reacting to community anger as opposed to proactive moves by the administration. And, you know, under normal circumstances, some of the things that the administration announced and that the president was trying to do would have been hailed. But because they were being announced in the shadow of the DOMA brief, they took on the feel of being reactionary. And as some gay rights advocates had said, you know, too little too late.
Well, there was also the example of Bill Clinton when he tried to change policies at the beginning of his administration, and that wound up setting off a firestorm and causing him all sorts of trouble for the next 4 years or so. You mentioned health care as a major issue in his speech, I'm sure, because he's already called for a passage of a health care bill before the August recess in Congress. And Congress seems to have made some progress. But left and right both seem to be rather unhappy with what's being proposed right now. Is that going to be a problem? Why is it so hard, if everyone agrees that the current situation is a complete mess, for Congress to come up with some kind of solution?
Well, it's so contentious and it's so hard, as it was when Clinton tried to do it, although the circumstances have changed and the players are more inclined to work with the administration up to a point in trying to craft this bill. Look, it requires really tough decisions and really hard choices for the people on Capitol Hill and in the White House who have to fashion a bill that can be passed and that the president will sign. But then, once it's signed, it's going to require a lot of the American people and American business to make it work. And again, you know, they're crafting this health care bill in the shadow of one of the worst economic times in recent memory. And so lots of the issues, and I think the primary reason why there's so much trouble in getting this bill together is cost. Where's the money going to come from?
And what about pressure from lobbyists, which many people who are unhappy seem to point to?
Oh, well, lobbyists are always going to be a part of the equation. They're always going to be pushing and pulling and trying to get the best advantage for whomever they're lobbying. But again, still, the issue here is we're looking at a health care bill, when all is said and done, range between right now between $1 trillion and $1.5 trillion. And no one knows exactly where all of this money is going to come from. I see the New York Post on its front page. I'm going to make sure it's the Post. The front page says, sick joke. New York's risk takers would pay 57% tax under Obamacare. That's why it's so hard. While the House can pass a bill that puts on what's being called the millionaire surcharge, charging people, depending on how much they make, above $280,000 if you're an individual, and I think it's $350,000 for a family, putting a surcharge on their salaries, that made it through the House, is making its way through the House. But it's already being said that that's not going to fly in the Senate because there are folks who feel that, you know, you're slapping taxes on people who, because they make so much money, they're the ones who are generating income, and the ones who can create jobs, and the entrepreneurs who are going to create the businesses that will put America back to work.
But didn't America's economy boom when we had a graduated tax? In fact, one in which the wealthiest paid a lot more than they do today?
Well, I think what people are looking at is not just the surcharge that they're thinking of putting on high-income earners in this health care bill, but they're also looking at what will happen in a year or two when the Bush tax cuts expire. And so now this is the argument that you're hearing from opponents to what Congress is trying to do. So you're hitting them with the health care surcharge, and then the Bush tax cuts will expire, so they're basically going to get a tax increase. And so that's – can't forget that in terms of, you know, what people are saying about their support or their non-support for what's happening with health care.
I'm talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jonathan Capehart. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Let's talk a bit about Sonia Sotomayor. Her confirmation hearings are wrapping up today. What do you make of all of the questions about her wise Latina woman comment?
Well, you know, I knew that that was going to be something that the Republicans were going to pounce on. Everyone going into these hearings, it was pretty much conventional wisdom here inside the Beltway, and now having been here 2 years, I now understand exactly what that means. The conventional wisdom was she was going to get confirmed. Barring any disaster on her part, as I think it was Lindsey Graham said, unless you have a complete meltdown, you're going to get confirmed. So what they're by harping on that, they're trying to get her on the ropes, trying to knock her off her game, if you will, trying to get her to show a little passion, but they're also setting up a marker for whomever the next appointee might be, and making it clear that that's the only thing they had to go on. Notice, in the past, nominees have been clobbered. I mean, clobbered over their decisions from the bench. She has a 17-year record, and the Republicans aren't clobbering her over her rulings or a lot of her decisions. From the bench, they're clobbering her over things she said outside of the courtroom. And a lot of people are having a problem with, okay, we don't quite understand how this person who could say, you know, say the wise Latina line, but then, you know, she's in court and she has this rather reasonable, within the mainstream of liberal judges. How is that possible? And I find it rather ironic that you've got Republicans who are hell bent on ignoring her judicial moderation and instead focusing on things she has said outside the courtroom.
Well, do you think that the Republicans are sending a message to President Obama that, with their questioning of Sotomayor, that any nominee more liberal than she will not be confirmed in the future?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's what I was getting at when I said.
So this is a really posturing for an ideological base?
Well, it's both of those things. That's what I meant when I said, you know, they're sort of they're laying down a marker and sending a signal to whomever the next nominee might be that, you know, if you have anything like that in your past, any of these speeches or things like that, you're going to be questioned rather fiercely about it. But also, you know, here's a party that, you know, for all intents and purposes, the Republican Party at this point is a regional party. And you have Jeff Sessions, who's leading the questioning, who, you know, it's not going to hurt him at all to go after her, given, you know, given his constituency. Yes, all those folks on the dais are playing to the hometown crowd. When, you know, Chuck Schumer and his questions playing to folks in New York and to liberal Democrats and to the Democratic Party, and Jeff Sessions is playing to the conservative crowd, the Republican Party, and folks on the right who are very, very fearful that a liberal judge will get on the court and fundamentally shift the way things have been going. And
but the Republican Party has been wooing Hispanic voters over the years, hoped eventually to get a majority of Hispanic voters to vote for them. This might very well offend or alienate any number of them.
Oh, sure, absolutely. And that's why it's been so that has been dangerous for them as well. But, you know, they have had and will continue to have a hard time with Hispanic voters. I mean, let's not forget their problems with those voters didn't start with the questioning of Sonia Sotomayor. They started with some of the ugly tactics and comments related to immigration. And, you know, for the longest time, it seemed as though Hispanic voters were in a steady trend-wise march over to the Republican Party. And we saw, if I remember correctly, in this last election, that Hispanic voters, they stopped that march and turned their attention to now President Obama.
Now, we don't have much time, but I'd like to talk a bit about what's going on in the Republican Party. How much do you think the scandals like the one involving Mark Sanford or the one with John Ensign will actually hurt the party?
Well, the problem that the Republican Party has, you know, started before this past election, and they were just brought into high relief. They spent a lot of time moralizing, telling people what they should and shouldn't do, can and can't do, and yet those very same people weren't living the life they were telling other people they should live. In this last election, we saw the Democrats get more votes than Republicans compared to the 2004 election. There's a great map in the New York Times from a few days after the election showing that basically the Republican Party is now a regional party, and that is a southern party and a party that hugs along the Appalachian Mountains. And if the party wants to reach out to independents and maybe some conservative Democrats, they're going to have to give up the moralizing and hammering away at social issues the way they have been. And when you look at Mark Sanford and you look at John Ensign from Nevada and you look at, if you want to go back further, go back to Newt Gingrich and all these folks Mark Foley, you look at the party of family values being represented by these people who have shown some major human failings. It makes it difficult for those independents and those conservative Democrats to take that party seriously and to take those messengers seriously. And I think also that the selection of Sarah Palin as the vice presidential nominee, I think, while initially was very exciting to have a Republican woman on the ticket, she did not help matters by showing herself to be woefully unprepared for the job she was seeking.
On the other hand, Jonathan, a recent USA Today Gallup poll reveals that 71% of Republicans said that they would vote for her for president.
Yeah, that's 71% of Republicans, and as I said before, of a severely limited limited party now. It is a regional party. There was another poll that came out, I believe it's either late last week or early this week, that showed, asked a different question. Is she prepared to be president? And an overwhelming majority of Republicans and Democrats said no.
Now, just one more thing, because we have about a minute to go.
Sure.
Michael Steele, who's the first African-American Republican Party chairman, spoke at the NAACP convention on Tuesday. How was his speech received?
Well, I mean, it was received with polite applause, you know, the kind of applause you would hear at a golf outing, golf championship. Look, Michael Steele has a tough job. You know, running a party that has not been terribly friendly to African Americans or people of color, and he's trying to pull it in a direction that it doesn't seem to want to go in. So his showing up there, I think, at the NAACP convention is it's a sign of respect. It's a good thing to do, but he, of all people, has to know that he's talking to an audience that isn't going to listen to him. Barack Obama is president of the United States, and he's in the Democratic Party, and they're with him.
Jonathan Capehart is the Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial writer for The Washington Post, a regular contributor to MSNBC and to WNYC. And I want to thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thanks, Leonard.